Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. On today's program, we're going to focus on the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants, including students and academics who protested Israel's war in Gaza. In recent weeks, the transfer of hundreds of Venezuelans to El Salvador's notorious mega prison has drawn widespread attention. But despite a Supreme Court directive asking the government to facilitate the return of detainees, Mother Jones reports that the administration, citing the Alien Enemies Act, is planning to send more Venezuelans to El Salvador's Terrorism Confinement Center, or CECOT. To get the latest, we're very pleased to be joined by Isabella Diaz. She's a reporter at Mother Jones Magazine, writing about politics, immigration, and culture. Her work has appeared in The Washington Post, Slate, The Nation, Pacific Standard, Texas Observer, and elsewhere. It's good to have you back on the program, Isabella.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, I hear a little bit of an echo, but hopefully your audio is good, and it's good to hear you. Well, Isabella, let me start with some breaking news. We just heard this morning that U.S. officials have arrested a Wisconsin judge and charged her with helping a man evade immigration authorities in what appears to be a dispute between the Trump administration and local officials over immigration enforcement. I understand that the Justice Department has lodged a criminal complaint against this judge, Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan, for refusing to turn over a man after immigration agents showed up to arrest him in her courtroom. Just since you cover immigration, Isabel, I just have to ask you, do you have any thoughts about what we're seeing here? I know the criminal complaint was just released. This is breaking news, but wanted to get your reaction to this breaking story.
Yeah, I mean, it's, everything is moving really fast. I haven't really had the opportunity to look closely into that case. I know my colleagues at Mother Jones are diligently trying to figure out what is happening there. So I think, you know, I would encourage the listeners to look for our reporting on that shortly on our website.
Yeah, absolutely. I know this is unfolding now as we're discussing it. So I imagine that we'll have to see what the reporting says and also look at the details of the criminal complaint. But obviously, a major escalation here to have the Trump administration actually arrest a sitting judge. So this will be a story that we'll have to keep following. But Isabel, let me pivot and move on to the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. This is now a notorious case, a young man with no criminal record, married to a U.S. citizen, deported by the Trump administration's own admission in error to El Salvador. A number of Democrats have gone to that country to meet with him, calling for his return. What is the latest on his case based on your reporting?
So I think, you know, the case of Abrego Garcia has rightfully gained a lot of attention, as you just said. And I think precisely because it was the one instance in which the Trump administration seems to have acknowledged that they made a mistake, right? That it was an administrative error. That was their initial argument, that he shouldn't have been sent to El Salvador. And the reason why he shouldn't have been sent to El Salvador is because there was an order from an immigration judge that specifically protected him from deportation to his home country on the basis that he was going to be, you know, facing persecution in El Salvador. So, you know, I think what's striking about this case is that the Trump administration could have technically removed him to, you know, try to deport him to another country, just not El Salvador, because of the judge's order. And, you know, my understanding is that Abrego Garcia has since been moved to a different prison in El Salvador ever since Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland visited him a few days ago. And now he is in a slightly less, you know, maximum security prison there. And I was just, you know, actually reading earlier today, there is this great new report in The Atlantic by Nick Minroff, who was the person who first broke the news of the Abrego Garcia case, in which he describes how initially the Trump administration was actually discussing internally plans to bring Abrego Garcia back the attorneys within the Department of Homeland Security were concerned about his safety in the terrorism confinement center prison in El Salvador. And there appears to have been, as his case started getting more attention and widespread criticism, it seems like the Trump administration, based on this reporting, changed their tune and then started saying that it wasn't actually a mistake and that he was rightfully sent to El Salvador, which is not true.
So is there any update on the potential for him to be returned to the United States as the courts have ordered?
No, the Trump administration has really been doubling down on, they continue to insist that Abrego Garcia, as well as so many of the other people who were sent to CECOT last month, that, that they are criminals and that they are terrorists and members of MS-13 or Tren de Aragua, and all the while providing very, very little evidence to support those claims. And so far, the administration's stance on this is that they cannot be, the courts, the U.S. courts don't have jurisdiction to compel them to return Abrego Garcia, that would be, an undue interference in the conduction of foreign affairs, and that essentially that they can't force the hand of President Nayib Bukele. Essentially, they're saying, there's nothing we can do about this. But I think it's, safe to say at this point that this is not really about the administration's lack of ability to return him, but rather their lack of will to do so.
And so what's the next step in this case? Is there going to be another judicial proceeding? Where are we in terms of the litigation?
My understanding is that, the lawyers representing Abrego Garcia, they said that they are not going to rest until they bring him home. There are the proceedings are ongoing. And again, my understanding based on the latest reporting is that there will be, closed hearings where some sealed evidence might be discussed. And I think we are going to have to wait and see what happens there. But I don't think this case is going to end anytime soon.
We're speaking with Isabella Diaz, reporter at Mother Jones Magazine. She writes about politics, culture, and immigration, the subject of our conversation today on Your Calls Media Roundtable. And Isabella, the administration appears to be instilling fear among the population of undocumented immigrants in this country. And it seems like the situation is really deteriorating. But I'm wondering what you are hearing from the undocumented community. Is this instilling fear, or are we seeing a change within that community in terms of how they are responding to what's happening with this crackdown?
Yeah, I mean, the whole Trump ran, his presidential campaign on the premise of conducting the largest, mass deportation operation in the history of the country. And, I think that to the extent that he is trying to accomplish that and, boosting and taking immigration enforcement to previously unimaginable heights, or at least trying to do so, part of the method there and the strategy is to try to make undocumented immigrants and even immigrants with a more temporary legal status to feel so unsafe and like they can't stand on their own 2 feet in the United States that their life becomes impossible, and then that they would, conceivably choose to self-deport. I think that's part of the administration's goal here. But of course, we know that so many of the immigrants who live in the United States currently have been here, for decades in some cases, or they have fled unimaginable, things in their home countries. And so the idea that they might, that would be an easy choice to say, I'm just going to leave the United States, I think is rather unrealistic. But yeah, I think, the creation of this atmosphere of fear is very much part of their strategy. We see how the administration is relying very heavily and aggressively on, social media, posting photos and even like kind of comic, like cartoon type graphics, about like if you enter unlawfully, you're going to be sent to this prison in El Salvador. So I think, you know, fear is definitely part of their campaign here. And it is understandable that communities across the country are feeling on edge and, you know, might be choosing to not, you know, go and participate in public, you know, civil society in ways that they normally would and might, you know, choose to let go of certain rights that they have, which is obviously very disturbing.
And for you as a journalist, has it been challenging for you to get access, and maybe for other colleagues of yours who are covering the story around how undocumented immigrants are reacting to this crackdown? Has it been challenging for you to get access to these immigrants? Are they willing to speak? I would imagine this culture of fear would also make them very reluctant to want to talk to journalists too.
I think that has always been, you know, kind of the case to a certain extent. You know, the immigration enforcement has been a feature of the system for a really long time in this country. But I certainly feel like, and I imagine my colleagues as well, that there is more of a sense now that, you know, disclosing any information about your name or your location, if you are undocumented, could put you in jeopardy. And you know, it's not an unjustifiable fear by any means. You know, we have been, my colleague Noah and I have been reporting on cases of Venezuelans who are still in detention and who almost got, you know, deported. It isn't clear whether they were going to be deported to Venezuela or sent to El Salvador, but they were on the brink of being sent somewhere last week. And the only way we were able to connect with them was by talking to family members and community members first. And a lot of those people, you know, asked us, please do not name me. You know, I am scared of immigration enforcement.
Yeah, absolutely. Hard to blame them. I want to let listeners know that this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the latest on the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants and illegal immigration in this country. The number to call if you want to join this conversation, if you have thoughts about what could be done to oppose the administration's efforts to deport people, what all rights appears to be illegal and potentially unconstitutional deportations to foreign prisons like the Cicot prison in El Salvador. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you are an undocumented immigrant yourself and want to relay a story or talk about what you are experiencing and you don't want to be on the air, you can email us at yourcall@kalw.org. But again, the number is 866-798-TALK. And we are speaking with Isabella Diaz, reporter at Mother Jones Magazine. Isabella, you were just talking about your recent reporting on Venezuelans facing deportation, and you have a recent report focusing on the case specifically of Omar Cardenas Martinez, a young Venezuelan man currently held at the little-known Blue Bonnet Detention Center in West Central Texas. Can you tell us more about the story, who he is, and how he ended up there?
Absolutely. So Omar Cardenas, he entered the country in 2023. He had an appointment through what is called the CBP-1 app, which was an application that the Biden administration had put in place so that migrants could come to a port of entry and, you know, enter the country legally. He applied for TPS, temporary protected status, and eventually he got a work permit and a social security card. He was working at an AGB supermarket in Texas when he was detained. And in last week, on April 18th, on Friday, Omar called a relative of his from Blue Bonnet, this detention center in Anson, Texas. And he had just been transferred there from another detention center a few hours away. And he told his relative that he had been handed this document. It was a document that said that he was going to be removed under the Alien Enemies Act, this wartime statute that the Trump administration has been using to allege that Venezuelans are members of the gang Tren de Aragua and then should be removed from the United States without any due process. As this was happening, a lot of lawyers across the country started to get, you know, notice that their clients were being transferred from other detention centers to this place in Blue Bonnet in Anson, Texas. the ACLU very quickly filed a case in the Northern District of Texas to try and prevent what they imagine was going to be the imminent removal of, you know, a group of maybe dozens of hundreds of Venezuelans. And, you know, a few hours after we published our report, the Supreme Court actually intervened rather quickly and ordered the Trump administration to stop any, you know, removals of those detainees abolubonded until they had a further order. So this was, it's hard to describe how much of a last minute scramble this was. I mean, we have since talked to several other men who were put on buses and in a van heavily escorted towards what we think was going to be an airport. And they were rushed into these buses and vans. And after the Supreme Court order came out, the bus, they all turned around and returned to the detention center where they are currently sitting. Unclear what's going to happen to them. A lot of them have pending immigration cases. In some cases, they have already missed their court dates, which means that an immigration judge could, you know, just terminate their cases because they won't show up in court. So I think that's the next issue with all of this. What happens to these men who are still in detention and who could be facing deportation anytime soon?
Absolutely. Well, it's excellent reporting, Isabella. So congratulations and thank you for bringing these stories to light. I'm really struck by the fact that the ACLU was able to have success against the Trump administration here. It's seems like a pretty monumental victory for those trying to oppose what the Trump administration is doing. The fact that we've seen the Trump administration essentially ignore court orders in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, as we were just talking about. But in this case, they did turn the buses around, as you noted. It seems like a big victory for ACLU. Any further thoughts about what made ACLU successful here and how they're able to work so quickly here to thwart Trump administration policies?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, the earlier this month, the Supreme Court had already unanimously ruled that anyone subject to removal under the Alien Enemies Act is entitled to being properly notified that they are going to be removed, and then to give an appropriate amount of time to challenge, you know, their designation as gang members and challenge their removal. So that was a huge, you know, affirmation of people's rights. And then since then, there have been several petitions that have been filed all over the country, including in Colorado, actually just yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, a federal judge ordered the Trump administration to give at least 21 days of notice to anyone who might be subject to this summary deportation. So, yeah, I think there has been successful litigation, and I imagine that will continue to be the case all over the country.
And can you talk more about this Blue Bonnet facility? These detention centers are becoming more and more notorious, as we're hearing about, as I mentioned, and we've discussed the CECOT Center in El Salvador, we've covered the Louisiana Detention Center previously. What about Blue Bonnet? Talk about that facility.
Yeah, I've covered immigration and immigration detention centers for a really long time, and this is actually the first time that I have you know, come across it and reported on it. You know, that ICE has a very vast network of immigration detention centers all across the United States. And yeah, this one is just a little west of the Dallas area. And we were talking to, my colleague and I were talking to one of the detainees the other day, and he described, you know, this holding place where they were being kept as a huge dungeon. I think, you know, where they were surrounded by ICE agents. And, you know, I also talked to another detainee there who has really serious health issues. He has a brain tumor and has been having regular seizures and very strong headaches. And he said that being detained there has really, really worsened his mental health and just his health in general, and that he's really concerned about the kind of care that he will have there. So, you know, these are proper prisons with, you know, different standards of care and treatment, and you know, it's very hard to be able to access counsel from any of these detention places. You know, you have to pay quite a bit of money to be able to call family or anyone outside. So they are essentially, you know, shut off from the outside world for the most part.
You also report, Isabella, that in certain cases, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, had handed detainees notices in English, forcing them to sign that they are members of a gang, or at least requesting them to do so. I know a number of these immigrants, according to your reporting, have declined to sign this form. Can you talk about this form and the strategy here by ICE agents?
Understanding, and the ACLU actually filed the document, a copy of the document, and is this, you know, notice and a warrant, and it basically states that you're being designated as an alleged member of Trinidad-Aragua, and because Trinidad-Aragua is, you know, perpetrating an invasion and is a foreign terrorist organization according to the administration, then the document states that these men are subject to removal without the right to a hearing. And the document, as far as we understand and from speaking to detainees, was really just provided to them in English. In some cases, they, you know, even asked for if ICE agents could read it for them or could translate it to them. And those requests, when declined, one of the people we talked to tried typing it out on the messaging app where he could contact his wife and hope that his wife would translate it to him. So it seems like they all sort of like got together and agreed that they shouldn't sign something they couldn't read. And there was no information in that warrant, in that notice, you know, saying that they had the right to seek counsel, or, you know, how much time they had to file a petition to try and get relief from detention and from potential removal. So I think, you know, there is a general consensus that notice and the time that was given for them, you know, between receiving the notice and being put on plane or put on a bus and a van, that hardly would meet the requirements from the Supreme Court, right, to provide mm-hmm. an appropriate opportunity for this man to seek relief.
And Isabella, we've also seen a number of reports about detainees who have essentially gone missing. There was one story about a man in the upper Midwest who, a DoorDash driver who got confused, accidentally drove into Canada, tried to re-enter, was detained, is now missing. Can you talk about the status and latest on detainees who have essentially just dropped out of the system completely and their whereabouts are completely unknown?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not as egregious as that is, it's not entirely surprising considering how fast the administration is moving to try and very swiftly and, you know, to some certain extent, secretly try and, you know, dispatch these people to foreign countries. My colleague and I also last week, we talked to an attorney who said that she couldn't locate several, she said six or seven of her clients who had previously been in California, and she was trying to look them up on the ICE locator online system, and she couldn't find information about where they had been sent or where they had gone. You know, it's like people effectively disappeared. So it's unclear whether they were sent to another detention center or if by now, you know, some of these men might have effectively been sent to Venezuela or even El Salvador.
You're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we have Isabella Diaz joining us, reporter at Mother Jones Magazine. We're talking about Trump's immigration crackdown. We have a few minutes left, Isabella, but I'd love to keep you because I have a few more questions I want to ask you. And one of them is about the Trump's ultimate legal strategy here. Now, they have cited this Alien Enemies Act. They are essentially they are deporting people without any due process. They are saying the Alien Enemies Act, in a sense, trumps, not intending any pun here, some of the constitutional protections for these immigrants. What do you think is their ultimate goal here? It seems like this is set up a big clash with the judicial branch And they could be going through more legitimate means. They could be providing due process instead of trying to bring on this clash with the judicial branch. Do you have any thoughts about what their ultimate strategy is here?
You know, in order for the Trump administration to even come close to delivering on his promise to, you know, deport, say, 1 million people every year, which is an insanely high number, I think the administration is aware that they would have to use things, unprecedented, you know, tools, so to speak, including outsourcing detention to another country and using a wartime law that has only been invoked 3 times previously in history and always in times of war. But, you know, I think on a basic level, the administration and Trump himself, they seem to think that what they call, you know, aliens, enemy aliens, are not entitled to any rights. You know, Trump just posted on Truth Social the other day that if we were to have trials for all of these people, it would take us 200 years. You know, it's not feasible. So there is a very concerted effort here to, you know, basically strip immigrants, and you know, for now is the Venezuelan asylum seekers and, you know, undocumented men, but they could other groups, if you know, if they think that they can just use a wartime statue in a time of peace to essentially target any group that, you know, they deem to be an enemy of the United States. So I think, you know, we certainly haven't yet seen more litigation on the actual merits, you know, of whether it's constitutional or not for the way the Trump administration is using the Alien Enemies Act. But I think that will be, a huge showdown between the administration and the judiciary moving forward. And it could have really great implications for not just immigrants in this country, but I think really anyone else who believes and you know, relies on due process.
Absolutely. Ultimately, a clash in terms of the branches of our Constitution here. And so this is definitely much larger than just immigration, which, of course, is just much larger than just these immigrants themselves, but really affects everybody's rights in this country. Well, Isabella Diaz, I've kept you on a little bit longer than we anticipated. I just have one last question for you, since this is our media roundtable show, which is to ask you, what do you make of the media coverage so far on this immigration crackdown? And what else are you working on? What else can we expect from you?
I mean, I think the coverage, you know, particularly on this, like, very difficult cases of the Venezuelans sent to Cecotto, El Salvador, and you know, the Abrego Garcia case. I mean, these have been really impactful reporting. You know, we've also seen reporting, for example, from Bloomberg News that did, you know, analyze court records for the 238 Venezuelans who were sent to El Salvador last month and found that 90% of them didn't have, you know, they couldn't find a criminal history for. So I think it's been really important to confront the administration's, you know, flimsy claims and evidence on those fronts. So I've been, I was just really impressed by the kind of immigration reporting that is coming out these days. And my colleague Noah and I are going to continue to cover, you know, the cases of the Venezuelans still in detention. We should have a piece coming out soon about that. And yeah, we are still very much trying to learn more about, you know, what's going to happen to those who are already in El Salvador and whose cases in U.S. immigration courts are very much still ongoing.
Well, we'll have to have you back on to cover those stories and to hear the latest from your reporting. Isabella Diaz, reporter at Mother Jones Magazine, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thank you.
And coming up next, we'll have more on immigration. We'll talk about the case of Romesa Uzturk, the PhD scholar from Tufts University, who was detained and sent to a facility in Louisiana. So stay with us on Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back just after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show, so you can find out more information on our website. We're on kalw.org. You click news, you can find the Your Call program there. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line. Email us at yourcall@kalw.org. And you can call us anytime at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And now we're going to continue our coverage of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown with the very disturbing case of Romesa Öztürk, a PhD scholar from Tufts University. Öztürk was quite famously now apprehended off of the street late last month and is now being held at an immigration and customs enforcement facility in Louisiana. Öztürk is among more than 1,600 students, almost 1,700 students, who have lost their visas. According to Inside Higher Ed's count, people at more than 250 universities and colleges across the U.S. have had their student visas revoked. The lawyer representing Öztürk, Ramzi Kassem, told ProPublica that pro-Israel groups are providing the administration with a list of targets for its deportation campaign against non-citizen student protesters. In this case, of course, her abduction was captured on surveillance footage, which is, I think, a big reason why it's gotten so much notoriety. To get the latest on this case, we're very pleased to be joined by Hannah Alam, a reporter for ProPublica, covering national security issues with a focus on militant movements and counterterrorism efforts. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let me start just with that case. What is the latest now for Öztürk? Do you have any updates for us?
Well, the latest is she's still being held in Louisiana, and the legal fight now is over a judge's order. A federal judge has ordered the government to move her back to Vermont, one of the stops on, you know, this long driving tour that ICE took her on the night that that she was detained. So, you know, this has been part of a fight over jurisdiction. And so now a federal judge has given the government until May 1st to move her back to Vermont and have the federal case and have her held there while the federal case plays out there, the case challenging her detention. But there is still the immigration component that will still be playing out in that Louisiana court. So so now it's just sort of there's a showdown over that. The federal government has appealed. And we'll see what happens, but May 1st is the deadline.
So May 1st for sort of her location, and then there's the separate immigration process itself. So there's, it sounds like there's two fights, one over where she's located and then second over her actual immigration status. So this could take months and maybe more to resolve. Does that sound right to you?
I really don't know. I mean, these cases are very fluid. Just moments before I joined you, I saw a news bulletin that now the Trump administration has is dialing back its revocation, its sort of mass revocation of international students' visas. I'm not sure what that means for someone like Romesa and Mahmoud Khalil and others who were part of this other group, you know, sort of targeted for, you know, perceived protests. I don't know if that will affect them, but I mean, that just goes to show how, I mean, this was this massive campaign and now that's been walked back. So these cases are so fluid, the legal challenges are ongoing. And yes, in some of these cases, there are these two tracks to follow, the federal court challenges to the detentions, and then this sort of fast track deportation proceeding through immigration court that the government's pushing.
We're speaking with Hannah Alam, a reporter for ProPublica, about the case of Romesa Öztürk, the PhD scholar from Tufts University. And for those who are not familiar with Romesa, Hannah, can you just talk to us a little bit, tell us a little bit about her and her academic background and her abduction off of the street as well?
Sure. Yeah. So, I've spoken to Romesa's legal team, gone through all the court records, and then spoke to one of her closest friends, someone who had been with her just before her detention. And that really, all of those accounts suggest this, you know, sort of bookish, cat-loving, dare I say, kind of nerdy doctoral student who, you know, she's a child development advocate. A lot of her focus of her studies of her doctoral program was about child development. She has done outside work and had interests in sort of advocating for kids who are in violent situations. She was not known on campus as a firebrand or some kind of protester who's out front. She was very much sort of quiet, studious on campus. And she was a former Fulbright scholar. She's a 30-year-old Turkish national who, by the accounts of her friends and legal team, had been sort of hoping, oh, you know, maybe I'll go home to Turkey this summer and see my family. Then that came the visa crackdown on international students and these warnings from Tufts and other universities saying, you know, maybe you should postpone travel. So she was already kind of sad about that. Then, you know, she finds out in February or early March that she's landed on one of these kind of shadowy right-wing pro-Israeli sites that go after anyone sort of critical of Israel and go after particularly campus protesters. So she lands on this, and then she realizes, oh, you know, I could be caught up in this other dragnet, and suddenly becomes very worried. So right up until the moment she was taken, she had been worried about that very scenario and had talked about it even with her close friends and had, you know, kind of, you know, looked at what are my rights, done those sort of know your rights tutorials and contacted some legal aid outfits and things like that, because she knew that when you're branded that way and seeing that the, you know, Trump administration is going after people for these kinds of protests and speech issues, that she could be a target. And indeed she was.
Well, as you write in your piece covering her and her background and her abduction, she was not actually one of the protesters out there protesting Israel's war in Gaza. She had signed on to an op-ed, and as you write, she had been moved by the plight of children harmed by Israel's military actions in Gaza. And her abduction is very disturbing to watch. And I think, as I mentioned, that's, I think, why her case has gotten so much notoriety. Can you talk, for those who haven't seen the video, just what happened, and based on your reporting as well, what happened during that abduction off the streets?
Sure. And I do think that's what's so sort of egregious about, or, you know, what people are saying is so egregious about this case, is that, you know, she is not a big face of these protests on campus. And so, no, she had decided, you know, okay, I'll keep kind of a low profile. This is according to her friends and legal team. And so it was the month of Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting. She had been fasting all day, and she's in Somerville near the Tufts campus. And she is walking to an iftar to break her fast with other Muslims. And out of the blue, six plainclothes ICE agents swarm her. They're masked. She's very clearly alarmed, has no idea what's going on, it seems. She screams. And then within 3 minutes, she's bundled into a waiting car and driven off. And that was sort of only the beginning of what we saw on TV, on this footage that was broadcast all over. It led to outrage, protests in Boston and elsewhere, saying things like, if they're coming for the Fulbright students, who's next? You know, really kind of outraged at this treatment and this jarring scene of her being taken away. Little did we know until later, when, you know, she's filing through court papers her account of what happened after that video, that was really only sort of the beginning of her journey that night. She was then taken to, oh gosh, she was driven from New Hampshire, I think Massachusetts, New Hampshire, to Vermont. Then in Vermont, she's held for a few hours, then put on a plane in the morning to an outpost, an ICE outpost in Alexandria, Louisiana. Then she's driven again with other detainees to this, where she is now, this holding facility in rural Louisiana.
And she's had some pretty tough episodes even within this these facilities. I mean, you talked about her being moved around a lot, but it's pretty harrowing, just the asthma attack she's been suffering. Can you talk about the type of care and attention and her current condition in this facility?
Yeah, according to the court filings, I mean, she's filed this really sort of vivid statement describing the conditions of her detention. She says, you know, she was driven all night, not given access to an attorney or to a phone call. She was hungry for much of it. Remember, she'd been fasting all day. It was obviously very harrowing. She was just sort of passed from these, you know, sort of groups of agent to groups of agent. One of her attorneys said it was a relay race and she was the baton. And that in itself is, you know, the government argues in court, look, we were just looking for a place for her to stay. They didn't have, we couldn't find a bed where near where she was taken. But her attorneys say, no, this is a known legal tactic. This is a tactic to kind of muddy jurisdiction and thwart any attempts to for a judge at one of those stops to say, nope, she can't be moved further. So instead, she was hopscotched around all night and then put on a plane to Louisiana. In Louisiana, she has, and during all of this, she's has asthma, and the first of four asthma attacks that we know of that night that she was taken and driven all over before being flown to Louisiana. And then since being in Louisiana, she's suffered asthma attacks and has also, you know, complained of the conditions. She says there's a mouse in the cell and that that is damp, and that's part of the triggers for her asthma. And, you know, that once a nurse was taking her temperature and sort of took off her hijab, her religious covering, without asking. So she lost trust in seeking health, medical attention from the facility there. I should note that, you know, I put these questions to DHS, to Homeland Security, and a spokesperson, you know, denied that and said, no, the cells are inspected. We don't see signs of rodents, and she's given medical attention. And once she arrived in Louisiana, she was able to call an attorney. But indeed, just a harrowing ordeal. I mean, you think you're walking to dinner and suddenly you end up in Louisiana in a cell that, according to court filings, has 24 women in it. And it was built for, I think, 14.
That's really shocking. And it's great that you've been able to report on this and help shed light on what's happening to her. We're speaking with Hannah Alam, a reporter for ProPublica, covering national security issues. And she's speaking to us specifically about the case of Romesa Uzturk, a PhD scholar from Tufts University, abducted by immigration agents and now in a facility in Louisiana. The phone lines are open if you have questions for Hannah about the case of Romesa Uzturk, if you have thoughts about what should happen, what the U.S. should do, what opposition to what the U.S. is doing should be doing, you can join the conversation. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with any questions or comments that you might have at yourcall@kalw.org. So, Hannah, I wanted to ask you about the group that targeted Romesa. This is a group that is a right-wing pro-Israel group called Canary Mission that ultimately sort of promoted the op-ed that Romesa had signed on to, calling for divestment, I believe by her university, Tufts University, of businesses tied to Israel or based in Israel. And this group essentially doxed her and elevated her prominence as what they'd called an anti-Israeli kind of activist here. Can you talk to us more about this organization and how they operate and why they have so much influence in the Trump administration as they're cracking down on immigration here?
Yeah, Canary Mission is just one of this kind of constellation of groups like this that sort of scour the internet, go show up to campus protests, take pictures, publicize the names, the faces, and other personal information of protesters. You know, not much is known about them because these are sort of opaque groups in many cases. You know, investigative reports have uncovered some funding sources, a little bit of the structure, but really not much is known. And so, yes, there is this outsized influence that these groups appear to be having because they will, you know, they say that we are going after, you know, what they call rising anti-Semitism on campuses and that they want to expose that. But you know, if you look at the information and you follow up on some of these entries, you see that the information is exaggerated, cherry-picked, taken out of context in many cases. And, you know, in some cases, it really seems like a stretch. And if you look at Rumeysa Öztürk, we're talking about an op-ed in the campus newspaper, the Tufts Daily, over a year ago that she wasn't even the main author of. She was one of four authors of this letter. And then it was endorsed by over 30 other students whose names weren't listed in the paper. So again, she was just sort of signing on, it seemed, to this op-ed and had put her name onto this op-ed that was criticizing Tufts for not listening to student concerns. They were accusing Tufts of not, you know, divesting from companies that do business with Israel over these human rights concerns that the students raised in the op-ed. That is enough, even sort of mild criticism of Israel or U.S. policy toward Israel is enough to land on some of these sites. And that's what appears to have landed, you know, Rumeysa on the radar of Canary Mission. And then Canary Mission and these other groups also brag about, they send these, you know, notes to, they send this information to the administration. It's all very fuzzy. And the administration says, oh, we make our own decisions, but we do take into account a wide number of factors. But they kind of, you know, sort of not quite distance themselves, but just say, you know, sure, they might send us information, but so we, you know, that's not necessarily the sole basis of our decision. But in this case, you know, there's been reporting by the Washington Post that, you know, looked at internal State Department documents saying, or memos where the administration was really looking for something on Rumeysa Öztürk and couldn't really come up with anything that would be deemed sort of anti-Semitic or anti-Israeli.
And then, of course, I think you mentioned this, but Canary Mission has used Elon Musk's X to help sort of promote some of the people that they are targeting, and especially some of these immigrants, like in the case of Rumeysa. So do we have any evidence about their strategy, maybe coordinating in some way with Elon Musk's team? I mean, I think, you know, they can just use the platform as is, but just knowing how all these people are involved in the Trump administration, we don't have much reporting, but I'm just curious what we do know about the links between their activities and the Trump administration and who might be involved in this behind the scenes.
Really don't know in a clear way. The groups themselves, you know, brag and say, look, another one, you know, detained because of our, you know, expose. What I do know is that the result is pretty devastating for the entire population of people who are targeted on this. You know, people have said that they receive death threats for landing on these lists. They lose jobs, they lose internship opportunities. You know, even Rumeysa's friends were saying, even if she gets out of all of this okay, is this going to be the first thing that shows up when someone Googles her in the future when she's looking mm-hmm. for jobs and trying to rebuild her life? So, again, these are really shadowy groups with this outsized influence that, you know, it's really upending lives in some of these cases. This is what the attorneys and the legal teams and the targets themselves say led to their being on the radar of the authorities, is their landing on these lists.
Well, in the case of Rumeysa, she's a Turkish national. Is there any evidence that the Turkish government has been able to be helpful to her?
I think they've had contact, diplomatic, you know, sort of consular services. I know that her friend told me that Turkish diplomats were able to deliver her a new headscarf while she was in detention. So that's the extent. I really don't know what else the Turkish government is doing or how they might be lobbying here in Washington.
Well, Hannah, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to just close by asking you the same question I'd asked our previous guest here, Isabella. Just what do you make of the media coverage of cases like Rumeysa's? What would you like to see the media do differently? And just to add on another question, what can we expect from you next? What else are you working on?
Wow. Well, I'm continuing to follow these cases, and I'm always looking for, you know, sort of threads or patterns that we can see in this. I'm also on my normal beat looking at what the Trump administration and then the pardons for January 6th, what does that mean for militant movements and their operating space? But for now, I'm focused on the students.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you coming on to talk about this case, and we'll have to have you back on as you cover more of this really unfolding administration crackdown on immigration and catching people up into this whirlwind, people like Ro Mesa. So thank you so much, Hannah Alam, reporter for ProPublica, covering national security issues. Great to have you with us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thank you.
And that's our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit the Your Call page at kalw.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. You can follow us on social media and email your show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Today's show was produced by Malihe Razazan and Andrew Saltzman. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, and it's Your Call.